Blog Talk Radio.
Say it loud. We're black and we're proud. Welcome to today's episode of On Point. I'm in Studio A. My name is Don Allen, and my co-host and colleague and mentor, Mr. Ronald A. Edwards, looking through the glass here in Studio B. Mr. Edwards, how are you this afternoon?
Fine, Don. We had our really kind of first snowy day here in Minnesota, here in the so-called upper Midwest. You know, we didn't have a lot of snow last year and had about, I don't know, maybe an inch. Most, a lot of it's gone now in some of the greener patches, if you will. But anyways, folks talking about that. But we're talking about a little bit more heavier snow coming in, 4 to 5, 6 inches after midnight tonight, and it'll be howling and et cetera. Hey, by the way, Chicago Bears in town tomorrow to play the Christian Flounder, Minnesota Vikings. You know, Christian Flounder, the Flounder, the quarterback.
Yeah,
the Bears. In town, Vikings really need a victory here, buddy, or they're not even going to be close to the playoffs. Maybe some of them Viking fans out there will call and tell us what we should do with Christian Founder or Flounder, you know what I mean? Because he's both floundering and he needs to be found, because I tell you, he's playing some terrible quarterback, man. If that wasn't for Adrian Peterson, the black guy, you know what I mean? I don't know what would happen. By the way, a little later on the program, I want to talk about the Minnesota Twins. Boy, have they lightened up, if you know what I mean. Got rid of their last African-American ball player 2 days ago, Ben Revis. So anyway, what do we got, Don? I understand that some executives were concerned about too many blacks working in their own stores.
Oh, yes. As reported by the New York Times, on December 3rd, the EEOC, which is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, found that race bias in a firing at a Wet Seal store in Pennsylvania. The company's executive complained about too many black employees.
Now, wait a minute. Now, this was an executive of the Wet Seal company. This wasn't some, you know, guy that just came in and happened to be coming up from Mississippi or something and stopped at the store. This was an executive of the company that these people work for.
Yeah, the company's executives complained about having too many black employees at the manager's store in Pennsylvania. This suit was brought in collaboration with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Nicole Cogdale, a former manager at Wet Seal, who accused the retailer of racial bias, and her lawyer, Nancy DeMiss, was successful in showing probable cause in this case. And again, as reported about on the New York Times in a copyrighted story by Stephen Greenhouse on December 3rd. So this is another very interesting a piece as it pertains to America today, or black being black in America.
Wow, this is what the backlash from a month ago, that guy Barack Obama winning a second term. You know, a lot of big corporates said that they were going to do a payback, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, I've never really heard about anything like that, though I know that kind of discussion goes on in corporate America, but a lot of times, well, most of the time, they don't get caught with that kind of discussion, where they themselves, you know, the masters, you know, of the ship, if you will, say, hey, we're going too far with this equal opportunity crap, and we need to cut back. But, boy, that is something else. The executive of the company in question that hired these African-Americans decided that there were just too many black faces in this Pennsylvania store. Wow.
Yes, and there's 20 current and former employees have filed bias charges with the EEOC and the Coggins lawyers, and they're seeking a full class action suit in collaboration with the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, Inc. And so we'll see how that plays out. It seems that some these black folks in Pennsylvania understand how to use the NAACP, and maybe
let me just say something, though, Don. The NAACP Education Fund is separate from the NAACP Incorporated out of Baltimore. See, a lot of people don't know they're two different entities.
That makes me happy already.
Yeah, they did that many years ago because of possible sanctions and rulings against them and damages primarily. And so the NAACP Education Fund is really altogether, separate entity. But glad to see them do that, man. Maybe we can get something like that going up here in the big upper Midwest, man. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I agree 100%.
Right. I understand we've got some update here. I know you've kind of been under attack, Don. Some of the folks are saying that even continue to say that the Mariel Booker thing never took place. And then, this past week, couple days ago, the police kick in the door and storm into the house. I understand you've been carrying some stuff on your website. What are we looking at here?
Well,
retaliation?
There's some retaliation going on, Mr. Irvin. But also, too, a lot of people are giving me calls because I launched a couple of campaigns, per our show, to focus on WCCO and Channel 9 and some of the other stations that are not covering this news. And the last campaign was to call the general manager at WCCO and ask him, what the heck is going on down there. And as you know, this week in the production meetings, I informed everyone that we are asking for a community meeting with the general manager of WCCO to ask him about his procedures and what he does down there. Now, on the second tier to that, Mr. Edwards, many people have contacted me via my Facebook page and email and on my website, Independent Business News Network, to say that I should leave WCCO and Channel 9 and those stations alone. I shouldn't bother them. They're not the issue. But they don't understand that, police have been contacted. The police department has been contacted by not only, our team, but also by Mr. Booker's attorney, and asked for pertinent information in regards to this case. And it seems to be just a total obstruction of the free release of information as it pertains to the Minnesota Data Privacy Act. So, we're at a standstill as far as information goes. And I think that WCCO especially has a responsibility based on their corporate responsibility that says recognizing its influence as one of the world's leading media companies with assets that include national television networks, local TV and radio stations, interactive and outdoor media and publishing houses, CBS Corporation strives to use the power and reach for the public good. Its commitment to quality news coverage, community outreach and support, public service announcement, diversity efforts, and socially responsible content across its divisions has earned CBS distinction of being a public trust. Well, their affiliate here in Minneapolis, Mr. Edwards, or Twin Cities, I feel that a public trust.
No, go right ahead.
Yeah, and I don't feel that they're living up to their responsibility. Their corporate responsibility has deemed by their statement on the CBS corporate website that I just read, and there needs to be some answers. And those that challenge myself, the show, or Mr. Edwards, our call-in number today is 347-426-3904. And if you don't have a quarter, toll-free is 877-527-2878.
Yeah, let me do this, Mr. Allen, for our outstate and domestic and international audience. This latest chapter, if you will, took place a couple days ago when a SWAT team of at least 10 officers stormed the house that Jamarrell Booker resides in, which is at the far end of North Minneapolis, up around 49th and North 6th Street, up in that area. And he was not there, I think, by the grace of God. He, in fact, was at the hospital, because he's got all those serious injuries. He's got those plates in his face that were inserted medically, if you will, surgically. He has the cracked ribs. He has an eye, which is still just absolutely bloodshot. Every, basically, vessel was certainly ruptured, if you will. He has the stitches that are still in his head and et cetera. And so He was at the hospital, but his older brother and the brother's 14-year-old son were at the home when the SWAT team stormed the facility, took the door right off the hinges, and put the 14-year-old and father on the floor. It didn't seem like there was a lot of physical, but a lot of the verbal thing, which SWAT teams are taught to do that, screaming at the top of their voice. It's kind of like when you throw a flashbang grenade.
Yeah.
It disorients you, what I mean? But anyways, they maintained that they found a gun, a couple of scales, that's what they said, and a small amount of marijuana. Now, interesting enough, all of that was what was identified in the warrant, which was left on the table after they, finished searching the house, tearing it up, and leaving. They left the warrant on the table. People kind of have the impression that the authorities on these kinds of entries, what we call high risk entries, that like they knock on the door softly and say, we're the SWAT team, can we come in?
Yeah.
When they execute these high risk, and this was executed at 4:00 in the afternoon, there is no protocol with respect to being civil. I mean, so, get out the way, get down, comply, or et cetera. So the warrant said exactly what it was that they were looking for, and that's what they found. I mean, wasn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
The gun has not been tied as the first gun. The gun that showed up 2 days after the events of November 20th, when DeMero Booker was severely beaten into unconsciousness, was hovering between life and death, really, if you will. That gun showed up 2 days later after the car had been in the police impound lot. In other words, when you talk about custodial control, lawyers and things like talk about that. And, last week we had, for 30 minutes, we had the attorney for Mr. Booker. His attorney would be handling the civil matter. And, we didn't get one single telephone call from anybody.
No.
And some of those folks who I know are going after you head-to-head are people who listen in. Go back, listen again on demand, go back and listen again, and et cetera. But no one raised any questions, if you will. We're not, Mr. Allen, we're not being unfair, nor are we picking on Reggie Chapman at WCCO. We do raise some serious questions about the racial mindset at WCCO, if you will, and how they have, acted and what their practices have been with covering stories and et cetera over the last number of years. And we also must point out to our listening audience that WCCO Channel 4 here is owned by the corporation. It is not a privately owned television and radio station that has a franchise relation. It is owned by CBS. CBS is the godfather. And so, I'm saddened that folk don't want to deal with the issues of the beating of Mr. Booker. Now, the entry into the home where he resides, if you will, it looks like, that somebody is intent on making him disappear. Now, we want to say this, Mr. Allen, we talked about this in production meeting. Mr. Booker, for all of those of you out there that are, maintaining that, first of all, this didn't happen, didn't take place, Donnie and Ronnie were making this up, and et cetera, his next court appearance is Thursday, the 13th of December. And so for all of you that, are interested at transparency, veracity, truth, and et cetera, take an hour out, go down and find out what the exchange is between attorneys and prosecutors and et cetera. But if you have any questions for Ronnie and Donnie, give us a call. What I'm saying? By the way, we also want to say to our listeners in Indiana and Florida that there has been no additional progress with respect to the call and discussion with two grieving parents of two young men who were killed in this city back in 2010. Murders never solved. There are a couple names that were given to us over the air. Inquiry was made about if that individual was ever talked to. Nobody seems to know what we're talking about, or certainly doesn't know what the relatives, friends, and et cetera, of the two deceased individuals in that 2010 massacre, if you will. Mm-hmm. So any questions on that? Hey, feel free to give us a call. You know what I'm saying? But in the case of Mr. Booker, I just thank Don he was lucky not to be at the house.
Okay. Well, yeah, and this has been, you know, Mr. Edwards, as I'm looking at the AP wire here, you know, we're connected to Your Black World, and this is something that could have happened to Mario Booker, and I'm just going to go ahead and just real quick tell you the story. Police say another handcuffed young man shot himself in the head.
Oh, okay.
Chavis Carter, 21, according to police, committed suicide in back of the squad car. This is while he was handcuffed.
Okay, what jurisdiction was this in? Where did this happen?
And I'm just waiting for it. I'm reading it. It has its printing office, so we haven't
got it. Okay.
But yeah.
So a 21-year-old African-American, handcuffed, hands behind him in the back of a squad car, shoots himself again.
Yes.
Like in Jonesboro, Arkansas.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And so young Negroes are having a propensity for...
Hey, oh, did you just say Jonesboro, Arkansas?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, this is the story that's like resurfacing again. This is the exact same story that what you just said about the town is the exact
Jonesboro,
same
Arkansas. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And so we're wondering how does that kind of stuff happen. I make that correlation because this could have happened to Mr. Booker sitting in the backseat of the squad car. You know.
Well, now let me just clear so that we have absolute transparency. He never got to the backseat of the squad car.
Yeah, he did. Never.
Yeah,
did.
He was when the ambulance got there. He was laying in the middle of the street. Unconscious and already in a coma, okay?
Yeah.
They didn't even bother to put him in the back seat. They just beat him, whipped him right there in the street and beat him into unconsciousness. As we said before, and we repeat again, and his lawyer confirmed that a week ago today, he was in a coma for a little over 24 hours.
Yes.
Now, this latest happened where, Mr. Alvin, again?
This is the case in the Jonesboro.
This is the Jonesboro case you're talking about. Yes. By the way, I have associates there in the Arkansas area who were involved in some of the meetings, if you will, in Jonesboro during that particular period of time. It got a tad of publicity. The Reverend Jesse Jackson did come there to Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was very much involved in helping. The story changed a couple times. One of the things that was found out in that story is that initially the police said there were three individuals, the African-American who, you know, shot himself, and two Caucasians, and that they were smoking marijuana.
Mm.
2 weeks later, through the efforts of advocates and activists in Jonesboro, we found out that a young white girl was also with the two Caucasians and the young African-American who is now deceased. And what has come out of Jonesboro, Arkansas, since that tragic situation is that one of the officers was outraged that this, you know, young, pure white female was in the company of this black ape kind of thing. I mean, there's some testimony now coming forward. The Department of Justice, I do believe, Mr. Allen, has finally decided to take a look at the situation there. Again, young African-American, handcuffed, sitting in the back of the car, hands handcuffed behind him, by the way, is able to pull a .22-caliber pistol. And the reason I'm using the caliber of the weapon, for those that maybe didn't follow the story or say they didn't follow it, he'd been searched twice, by the way. He was able to pull the weapon from somewhere on his person, and in a manner in which he had to be, you know, like the old version of Plastic Man in the comic books, a contortionist. Mm-hmm. He took the gun, was able to bring it up, allegedly just behind his ear, if you will, and shot himself. Now, here's the only problem. That's a .22 caliber pistol. .22s don't have a lot of velocity. .22s that are .22 long shells that are fired out of rifles do have a pretty good velocity. .22s coming out of a .22 pistol don't have a lot of velocity. And what happened was the police initially said that the bullet entered and exited his head. Well, what happened was the bullet never could be found.
Oh, wow.
So that meant that the bullet actually lodged in his head, but you needed forensic evidence to make sure that the bullet matched with the .22 gun, right? okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so there became this whole question about later on what appeared to be a bullet hole in the roof of the car. The only problem is they had found an African-American woman there who, I'm not being funny when I say this, but if it's serious, they took her to Walmart's there in Jonesboro, bought her a couple of new outfits, and then on national television for that week and a half, 2 weeks that the white media looked at the story, they had her appearing to give a statement to the police. And see, she initially said that police officers shot the young African-American outside of the squad car, not that the young African-American shot himself sitting in the back seat of the squad car. Now, what's basically happened, though, national media, just as they've done in the case of Trayvon Martin, by the way, George Zimmerman said he's suing, I think it's NBC, for defamation of character. And his attorneys just yesterday announced that they're going on a PR blend to indicate to the world that their client, Mr. Zimmerman, has been wrong. And so, you know, the Trayvon Martin situation has kind of disappeared until the trial sometime in April or May is what I'm hearing.
Wow, okay. That's okay. Great.
So Georgie Zimmerman has be getting a lot of money's coming in for him, man. I'm telling you, George got some, you know, maybe some of the same people that gave money to Mitt Romney's campaign. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, old man Adelson out there in Las Vegas. You know, I wonder, do black folk who go out there to gamble in his casinos and who go to Asia and gamble in his casinos in Macau and Hong Kong, I wonder if they're, you know, giving their money to a man that despises people of color.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating because a lot of his wealth, old man Addison, comes from his casinos and gambling enterprises in the Far East. Funny world we live in, Don. Hey, what's that phone number again? Let's see if we got anything out there.
Yeah, guest call number locally here is 347-426-3904. Toll free is 877-537-2878. Phone lines are open. Give us a call. Mr. Edwards, you know, I was just reading in the newspaper, Minneapolis Police Chief forms new diverse leadership.
Boy, please. You took the words, Donnie, right out of my mouth. What's your question? Maybe we can deal with it. As a former overseer for the Department of Justice for this police department for 5 years, what's your observation?
Well, what my observation is there is, looks like she's grabbing folks out of the 5th precinct, and, I mean, how soon before she gets over to the 4th precinct and cleans that house?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm glad you asked that question. Mike Martin, commander of the 4th precinct, the precinct with the highest level of homicides and et cetera for the last 4 years, and now Mike Martin is out.
Mm.
A new precinct commander, officer by the name of Joss, I think the spelling is J-O-S-S. He is taking over. I'm glad you raised that question, Don. I probably wouldn't have, you know, even thought about it because I've been predicting it for quite some while. Mike Martin for Johnny Northside and that crew that are listening in. Mike Martin is out at the 4th precinct. He's going back to he's going back to the safe unit. So he'll be involved with the SAFE unit and what's the redesigned VOLTAC unit, Violent Offenders Task Force, et cetera. Yeah, but there have been some changes at both the precinct level and her deputy chiefs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very interesting. And is he Inspector Martin?
Inspector Martin. He'll be Lieutenant Martin. See, when you lose your inspector or deputy chief, you revert back to the rank that you held previously and that you're certified. Most of the folks, one of the things that Janae did, she eliminated the captain's positions. Now, they didn't lose their salary, but they lost their rank, and there are a number of officers who lost that, like the head of CID and et cetera. And what she's done, she's put in place a command structure called commander. In other words, you have chief, assistant chief, deputy chiefs, inspectors, and then the next, as opposed to captains, the next line of authority would be commanders and then lieutenant, sergeants, and officers.
Yeah, as you're saying, tell me this, Mr. Edwards, I'm actually posting it to those characters in that strange group that decide that anything we say is crazy or something like that. So
oh, okay.
to get them kind of in an uproar, you know. And
well, one of the things we need to say here from Minneapolis on this new command structure, in fact, Chief Harto has identified it as her executive team, is that she got some interesting diversity. She has an Asian, and that would be Deputy Chief Clark, if you will. Excuse me, he's Assistant Chief, by the way, so he's the number two person. So we now have an Asian as the number two command officer in the Minneapolis Police Department, and we have a female as the top commander. And then she has a African-American, a fellow by the name of Frizzell, who was previously the commander in the first precinct, which is the downtown precinct. And then we have Lucy Gerald, who is being brought out of the third precinct as inspector. She will kind of carry the title of deputy chief until she is reassigned and becomes commander. It's kind of puzzling on that. She becomes commander of the training division. We're going to train our officers here in Minneapolis to do a much better job. That means you're going to get your brains beat out better. But anyways, and then you have our Deputy Chief Grumpy, who you see there, who was previously the head of Internal Affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so that's her five-member executive group, and she'll be looking to do some things in, like, CID, that's the Criminal Investigative Division. Of course, homicide, the assault unit, sex crimes, juvenile, if you will. Of course, Homeland Security. Now, Don Harris, an African-American who used to be a deputy chief, then got demoted to down all the way down to lieutenant, has been heading up our Homeland Security entity, which is a very interesting group because, you know, we have so many Somalis here, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so our Homeland Security group, you know, really keeps an eye on them and keeps an eye on black people here in the Twin Cities who maybe have the wrong kinds of contacts internationally. You know what I'm saying, Don?
Oh, yes.
In fact, what happened, the previous kind of head of the Homeland Security intelligence gathering, now not Lieutenant Harris, but a young Caucasian woman was selected just out of the blue to work with the United Nations and their intelligence gathering in Africa. Working closely with the United Nations, of course, and, of course, the U.S.'s new African command in Africa.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah. So we have here in Minneapolis, for our listening audience, both domestically and internationally, we have a rather interesting relationship to the international sphere, if you know what I mean. And a lot of it has to do with the large, large Somali population here, particularly in the metropolitan area. So that is a position that is being highly touted as a part of the, you know, the next war on Islam kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow.
But give that number again. Maybe you've got some internationalists out there that may have some questions. But, yes, you're absolutely correct. That new her new executive team is in place and on the move. But Mike Martin, say it again. Mike Martin. Mike, sorry to see you go there, buddy. Mike Martin's gone out of the 4th Precinct, but he's going to Safe Streets. He's going to Safe Unit. So he'll still be around there on the streets dealing with unsolved crimes.
Oh, wow. There's a whole book full of those. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. Toll free is 877-537-2878 if you'd like to give us a call. Mr. Edwards.
Don, big article this morning's edition of our Minneapolis Star, Johannesburg Times, if you will, a name that I gave to them 30 years ago. Announcing that, you know, we have a beautiful football stadium that's going to go up here in the Twin Cities. The Vikings, you know, the legislature gave them kind of a sweetheart package, and we're going to build, it'll be a $1 billion lovely stadium right on the site of where the current stadium is at, which means that the University of Minnesota gets a couple years of money because the Vikings will have to, at least for one season, play at TCF Stadium on the campus of the University of Minnesota, home of the Minnesota Gophers. And so yesterday, the Sports Facility Authority, created by the Minnesota legislature to guide, manage, direct, if you will, the building of the beautiful Viking Stadium, and of course the name will change because, you know, big money and naming rights and things like that, right? But something has happened in our community, and that is there apparently is going to be an emergency meeting. Maybe we can get one of our friends who refers to us as Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, maybe he wants to call in, because there's a big meeting of your African-American economic construction leadership, emergency meeting on Monday, because it appears that they maybe got a signal on Friday and even before that there's really nothing out there for the African-Americans, and I would invite them and others across the country to examine my column in this week's edition of the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, the oldest and most powerful black newspaper in the state of Minnesota, where I asked the question, your good friend, Don, Ms. Corvell, where is the equity plan? And what happened, Don, they didn't get the equity plan into place? You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And the Sports Facility Authority is now in deep negotiations with a number of big, big contractors, or what you call contract construction managers. I mean, these are big boys. I mean, they do the billion-dollar projects and et cetera. And we had recommended, Don, a couple months ago, not like yesterday, but about 4 months ago, that we our leadership, you know, the leadership that we get a chance to see from afar, you know what I mean? And kind of look like, you know, that we're, you know, just awed. I had said that unless they got the language of diversity incorporated in the legal language when the contract is signed between the construction manager or the construction management firm and the sports facility and, of course, the Vikings, that diversity and civil rights wasn't going to work because the Supreme Court has kind of spoke on that. Don, I guess, my friend, they didn't get that done in a timely manner.
No, they did not.
So there's an emergency meeting, Louie, of your group and others, because they're all upset. Now, that means that they, you know, kind of want us, the community, to kind of get out here and mau-mau, you know what I mean, kind of take to the streets like they're doing in Cairo and Athens, you know what I mean, the masses screaming and hollering while the leadership cuts a deal on you. But there is nothing on the table for the African-American community here in Minnesota for the Viking Stadium. Now, the Native Americans have taken care of their business, and they've been in negotiations up on the reservations in northern Minnesota for the last 4 months. They've got some nice packages.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. I talked to Mr. Curtis Buck Knight. Alan Mackey has really been active on having conversations and correspondence with Governor Dayton's office.
Yes.
To position the Native Americans to actually get work, contracts, and jobs. Work and jobs being the same thing, of course, but just sounds good. On the new multi-billion-dollar, when they get done, football.
Viking Stadium. Yes, sir.
And then, Mr. Edwards, I'm glad you brought that up, because this brings up a lot of interesting questions. It's like, what are the National Association of Minority Contractors?
What'd you say?
I'm sorry. I'll whisper. And so what are they doing? What process do they have?
Here's the problem there. Inside of the Minority Contract Association, there was a coup d'etat about a month and a half ago. And my good friend Robert Woods was temporarily removed as executive director, and the chairman, Mr. Steele, was also removed. Then there was some kind of meeting, and there was a confrontation, and Brother Woods brought in about 20 brothers who kind of looked like they came out of one of those Al Capone movies, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And he allegedly was reinstated. Here's what happens. Ted Mondale, who is the executive director of the Sports Facilities Authority, in other words, he's the paid staff, though everybody is paid because the Sports Facilities Board, five members, are also well compensated, and the legislation allows that. And so what has happened is that some expectations have not, you know, materialized, if you know what I mean, and Ted Mondale has basically indicated that the blacks are a little slow and extremely slow, and then he says critically slow. I mean, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so the minority contractors have not been updated, I don't, since probably July on what was going to be there for him. We first reported a meeting in a suite at the Viking Stadium doing a game with San Francisco. That was the very early part of the season. And, you know, it looks like, you know, leadership of the so-called Minority Contract Association said, you know, just give us a couple dimes and a penny and we'll be okay. Now, for our listening audience, Mr. Allen and myself, met with the very top leadership of the Facilities Authority, including my good friend Ted Mondale. And that's where we were told that Velma Corvell and them had pulled a heist, if you will, with the Twins ballpark, the Minnesota Twins, the White Twins, if you will. And so to your specific question, I know I've elaborated maybe beyond what people feel comfortable with, but there is really no advocacy. I guess that's the word Mr. Allen and I would use. There's no advocacy that is currently at play that really could pressure the Vikings and the Sports Facility Authority to make sure that the African-American community gets a piece of the action. Now, I know that the governor had been concerned, but the governor became a little bit tense and testy when, you know, it was found out that the Vikings were going to put anywhere from 5,000 to 100,000 taxation on the seats. In other words, you'd have to first of all purchase a license to be able to eligible to, you know, buy a season ticket. Okay, so you know that was kind of testy. And then the Star Tribune, our good friend Star Tribune, who have a real economic investment here because they've got probably about $80 million worth of land that they want to sell. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's supposed to be a development package there with the building of the Viking Stadium. And so what's happened, everybody has kind of done the you know, kind of put the finger up to their lips kind of thing and let's stay quiet. So bottom line, there's nothing tangible that is in place for the black community, you know what I'm saying? And now here's what's happened. The only person that has really been hard on this is, and congratulations again to Senator Jeff Hayden, who has made history, is the Assistant Majority Whip of the Minnesota Senate. Now, Senator Hayden has been very, very aggressive. He warned black leadership in January, February, March, April, going into the signing. He warned black leadership and some of the groups that we've talked about, Mr. Allen, he warned them about the games they were playing and they were going to get themselves shut out of a meaningful economic inclusion and piece of the action in the Viking Stadium. Well, they, you know, sometimes our people don't look at calendars, and most of our leaders didn't realize there was going to be an election in November. And so what happened, the Democrats took back control of the Senate and the House,
mm-hmm.
and Senator Hayden came out on top. See, they were making fun of Senator Hayden. They were saying things like that he was irrelevant. Can you believe that? You know, these guys telling a state senator that he's irrelevant. Well, he's really not irrelevant now because he is the Assistant Majority Whip, okay? And so they're begging him now. Gary Cunningham, you'd recognize that name, don't you, whose wife is going to run for mayor of the city of Minneapolis. Gary Cunningham and others are now trying to mend fences with Senator Hayden and newly elected Senator Bobby Joe Champion. But Senator Jeff Hayden has really been the man that tried to keep everybody's feet to the fire and to look out for the best possible interest of all, but specifically the African-American community. Well, they didn't listen to him. They did everything they could to undermine him, if you will. And so now they don't – I guess I have to say it like this, Don. Our leaders – they don't have any friends at the state legislature.
Mm-hmm. No, none at all. It's a done deal. I actually had a conversation with Senator Hayden, who he says that he reads and listens and really likes, you know, what we're doing in all in your media outlets, Mr. Edwards, and my media outlets also. Mm-hmm. And one thing I think he appreciates that we've never gone after him because he's been kind of like the Robin Hood in corruption. I mean, not him being in corruption, but the Robin Hood, the guy who steals from the rich and gives to the poor and makes sure that we have ours. And mm-hmm. with that said, you know, I spoke with Mr. Robert Woods with the contract national
minority contract association. Yes.
And I spoke with the executive director. The chairman of the board, and I mean,
Mr. Steele. Mm-hmm.
It looks kind of hopeless. Somebody get paid somewhere, but it's not going to be it's going to be the usual suspects. I'll put it like that. And I don't understand what is wrong with us as black people, Mr. Edwards, that we can't come up with a plan to go after these dollars, like Native Americans and us in Minnesota sit on the bottom of every disparity there is in the country up there in Minnesota.
That's right. Absolutely correct. Mr. Allen, I don't know what to say. Again, these phone lines are open for those that have any questions about some of this information that we are imparting, not only to them, but to the world, if you will, about how things work here in the land of sugar and honey and paradise and white milk, if you will. I don't know. The thing is that it's so troubling and creates such personal despair is that this is a $753 million. They had $680, $690 in the paper this morning. The actual figure is $753 million that will be the amount in the construction. And then there will be about $225 million, $280 million in cost overruns. That's already guaranteed. That's already being negotiated on the East Coast because the Vikings don't have any loyalty to any of the so-called big construction companies like, you know, Krauss Anderson, M.A. Mortensen, Knutson, companies like that, you know. And the Vikings are indicating they want to go with a company that has been involved, number one, in previous construction of NFL stadiums like Jerry Jones's palace there in Dallas, the Lucas Oil facility in Indianapolis, the Giants and Jets stadium there in New Jersey, and the remodeling of the Philadelphia Eagles stadium there in Philadelphia. And Ziggy Wolf, you know, has basically indicated he doesn't know these people. He doesn't know anything to them. And I've been talking about in my column, and I've been talking about in this program since we re-aired, that basically every penny, with the exception of the law firms, like Dorsey and Whitney, has gone right out of the state of Minnesota. You know, the architectural firm that is doing and going to design, and they'll have a preliminary draft, I guess, by March of next year. They're headquartered in Dallas. The subcontract that they brought in is headquartered somewhere else. I mean, the money is basically going out of state, and no one is able to do anything about it.
Yeah, not at all. And, you know, that's very interesting because I just pulled up the former chairman of the board, or if he might still be the chairman of the board of the National Association of Minority Contractors, and I was going to give him a call and see if he picked up and maybe we can ask him a couple of questions. I know we got a couple more things to do here.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, call was not answered. Okay. Okay.
That's
the engineers are staying, but let me just see. They're signaling to me again here, and let's see what happens here. Let's see what happens, Mr. Edwards. Thank you, guys. Thank you. Thank you. Let's see if we.
Okay. And what is this gentleman's name, or is it a lady, or a man?
Jerry Steele from the National Association.
Oh, you're talking about here in Indianapolis.
Hello, you've reached Envirotech Construction. Please leave a detailed message, and we'll get back to you.
He is not available right
now. Okay.
And that was his cell phone, actually, and I was calling to find out if Mr. Edwards, if they knew what was going on. I just got an email from the reason why I did that, Mr. Edwards, because I had just received an email here in the studio from Blog Talk Radio, and we have a leeway of about 15 minutes if needed. So,
all right, so that means we have another 30 minutes. That's great. Appreciate it from them. Again, that phone number, phone lines are open. Any questions that many of you may have? Because we're talking about a $1 billion economic stimulus that could help the African-American community, which basically has been lost here in Minneapolis, in the metropolitan area, state of Minnesota, because there is no equity plan. There's no plan at all. In fact, one of the things that I talk about in my column in this week's edition of the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder is that, and it's something that really probably needs to be looked at by the Attorney General, even though, you know, Lori Swanson is a Democrat, there's this double dipping being done by the head of diversity for the Met Council.
Mm-hmm.
And some guy that she's got working for her who also has been the walking disaster of light rail in St. Paul, which is under the direct jurisdiction of the Met Council. And Wanda Kirkpatrick, you see, she and Aaron Cusco received a contract from the Sports Facilities Authority to allegedly help design the diversity plan that had initially by law been given to Velma Corvell of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department. Corvell, for whatever reason, couldn't even begin to get it done. She brings in her homie, and they get a contract. Only problem is that's a violation of the law, because how can you serve two economic masters, because they are state employees.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Wanda makes at least, you know, $90,000, $95,000 a year. I guess this guy, Aaron, makes probably $60,000. And yet most of their time is now working for the Vikings and putting together the diversity plan. And on the other hand, you pointed this out in the meeting with the Sports Facilities Authority mm-hmm. that the light rail that's construction that's going on in St. Paul, the capital of our beloved state, just across the river here from our sister city, if you will, that they're in noncompliance. They haven't met a single goal
Mm-mm.
of diversity.
No, not
and
at all.
And yet the head of the Office of Diversity for the Met Council and her principal assistant are double dipping.
Yes.
Double dipping, man.
And
everybody's looking the other way. But go ahead.
Yeah, and someone just actually texted me, Mr.
Oh, everybody's texting, scared to
yeah.
pick up that phone.
They don't pick up the phone, but they text me Robert Woods from the National Association of Minority Contractors.
Welcome to Verizon Wireless. The number you dialed has been changed, disconnected, or is no longer in service.
Sorry
if you
that.
Feel you have reached this recording in error, please check the number and try your call.
Okay, yeah, and his number is Prasada Don Grata.
Got it right.
Yeah.
Now, Robert Woods, you were saying he texted you, or someone on his behalf, or what?
Someone on his behalf texted me and sent me that particular number, and I'm actually telling them that is incorrect. Maybe they missed sent a digit, and so we're going to see here in a couple minutes what is going on with that, because it might just
okay.
been.
Well, I'll repeat again for our listening audience, our many listeners, and et cetera, that there is an emergency meeting on Monday somewhere here in the Twin Cities of all of these leaders, because I guess they just got the wake-up call, and the wake-up call said, we can't guarantee you anything for your little companies or anything like that. It's not etched in the language. Now, the bids, by the way, for those outside of Minnesota who are like, wow, and the NFL really should be embarrassed and concerned, particularly given all the black players that bring in all that revenue to the National Football League. But what, in essence, has happened is that the Vikings have basically indicated they really don't have any interest, because our community was given every possible chance to put a package together and to do something meaningful, and they couldn't do it. And now you've got Kirkpatrick and the Metropolitan Council pretending that they're working on a diversity plan. And the actual bids, according to a copyrighted story this morning's Minneapolis Star Tribune, Johannesburg Times, the actual timeline, which continues to be pushed back. By the way, I got to tell you, Mr. Allen, as one who has followed this very, very closely,
mm-hmm.
a target date of October of next year to begin to break ground, that's going to create a problem, because they've got to have that stadium ready.
Excuse me. Sorry.
By the end of July 2016, or they will have broken a contractual understanding with the NFL and with the owners of the Vikings. And I was a little surprised, because you know, you can break ground in October if you want to, but, you know, it goes better if you're in one of those tropical climates. This is Minnesota. You know, that permafrost and everything comes into play.
Yes, it does.
But it looks like, and here's the reason, if we have it, because it looks like we don't have to worry about any calls, though. We'll continue to talk about it. The state and the city of Minneapolis don't have their portion. Did you know that? Realize that?
Yes, I did.
Minneapolis is about 80 million short. The state may be as much as 270 million of its 300 million. See, part of the deal that was cut, the Vikings were actually going to had to put the greatest part in, because everybody was talking about Ziggy Wolf needed to pay for his stadium. And so they said, okay, we'll put 377 million on the table, okay? And in fact, at the first meeting of the Sports Facilities Authority back in August, the Vikings came in with a check for $50 million. Okay, the NFL gave them a loan of $200 million. Ziggy took the rest of it out of his pocket by borrowing from banks and et cetera. Anyways, what's happened is that because the electronic pull tab scenario has fallen flat on its face here in Minnesota, as you know, we have a $1.1 billion deficit here in Minnesota, and part of that is the fact that the state does not have its $300 million to build into or pay their portion of the Viking Stadium, and the city of Minneapolis probably really does not have their $150 million to do their part. And so the Vikings are looking around like, well, you know, what kind of reneging is this? You know, we're not going to put any more money into the coffers. You know what I mean? you know what I mean? So part of the battle that's going to go on, just for the purpose of, you know, discussion and maybe our, stirring a little bit of interest from the so-called sports fans, is that the Vikings have said we will take responsibility for managing the actual construction of the stadium, which means that they have all sign-off on how the contracts are awarded, how the monies are paid off, which then leads to the possibility that the construction manager or construction firm that will receive the $750 million contract will be some company from the East that has had a previous relationship with the Viking ownership, but more importantly with the NFL on some of the previous stadiums that we talked about. And I tell you, Don, that's not sitting well, if you will. But the state of Minnesota and the city of Minneapolis are not able to deliver on their commitments. Okay, they don't have the dollars, man. When the governor found out that only 73 of a projected 300 bars in Minnesota had agreed to take on the electronic pull tabs, that's when the economic disaster hit here.
Yeah, there was a story on Minnesota Public Radio about that by Tim Nelson, the gentleman that's covering the stadium issue, that said that, you know, these pull tabs, you know, they're supposed to make so much a day, and they're not even making a fraction of that. So
absolutely.
And one thing that the city of Minneapolis and the state of Minnesota doesn't understand, that the NFL, you know, one of the largest nonprofits in the world, by the way, are good business people, Mr. Edwards.
Absolutely.
And deal with billions of dollars and many people, and it's vast and deep, and you know, there's nothing to sneeze at. And from Velma Corbell and the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights down there to Wanda Kirkpatrick from Met Council working down at the Sports Facility Authority, you know, these people got to understand, they got to step up to the game or step up to the plate, because we're not going to get anything. And that's something else real quick here I need to harp on. One of my white friends, Mr. Edwards, says, why are you guys always talking about black jobs? And he's a generally, Mr. Edwards, he's actually a client of mine also. He's a nice guy. And he just doesn't understand. Okay. And so what I was able to tell him, I says, you know what? How many of your friends are not working right now? And he's in construction.
Oh, my God. Okay.
And then, yeah, he goes, well, I got quite a few buddies that are supervisors and managers. I says, well, put it like this. If we're working, you guys are working.
That's right.
We always have to have people supervise. You know, you get good supervisors out there. I says, we have to fight to get just these little small crumbs and pieces. okay, or else we'd be overlooked totally. Whereas you are grandfathered in from the beginning, from your dad's business, from his dad's, and on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that we're racist. It's not that we hate people, white people, at all whatsoever. It's a thing that you have to say, hey, black, we're proud. We want opportunities also. We want a fair share of the pie. And it's the bottom line. And it's unfortunate for 400 years we've had to push that agenda.
Yeah.
And so, and then another tier to that is, you know, where are these black leaders at in town? You know, I mean, I'd like to congratulate Miss Josie Johnson on getting awarded a humanitarian award from the Minnesota Human Rights Department.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah, that was really wonderful. And I respect Miss Johnson and all that she brings to the table for the DFL. But, you know, when are the people in the street going to get some recognition? Or when are, you know, the common folks? I should say, you know,
I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. In fact, I understand in that gathering at the Urban League earlier in the week that Gary Cunningham, again, the husband of Betsy Hodges,
who's going to be running
for mayor in the city of Minneapolis, that Mr. Cunningham identified himself as the chief architect of one of the most successful diversity litigations in the history of the United States, and that was Carter v. Gallagher. Mr. Carter being an African-American along with others who had attempted to get into the Minneapolis or come into the Minneapolis and be hired by the Minneapolis Fire Department many, 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 many years ago. That's just totally untrue. I was shocked when I was told by a number of people who have some semblance of understanding the history that Mr. Cunningham had done that. Mr. Cunningham attempted to change the course of history and dates by pretending that he was involved in Carter v. Gallagher. He was not. And as one who sat as federal overseer on behalf of the federal court, for 20 years, I can tell you that old Cunningham was not involved, that Gary Cunningham was in no shape, form, or fashion involved with any aspect of Carter v. Gallagher. And I'm just shocked at how I'm beginning to hear stories now coming from some of the leaders about their historical greatness. You know, and some people now are so outrageous that they actually put themselves in the middle of a historical event either before they were born or while they were still babies.
Yeah. That's interesting. Very interesting.
Again, get that number out, Don. I'm really surprised that we haven't been tested or challenged, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sitting up here just puzzled. It's like last week, you know. The number, again, is...
Maybe we aren't being heard. But Blog Radio is hearing us because they said you got another 15 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, aren't there any questions for Donnie and Ronnie?
Yeah, 347-426-3904 is locally. You can call if you're in the Twin Cities, state of Minnesota, internationally, or out of Minnesota, dial 877-537-2878. And the phone lines are open. It's quiet. I know we're broadcasting this, Edward, because I just called the guest call-in line on my cell phone just to make sure, and everyone here seems to think we're broadcasting, and we are. And so we'll just let it roll from here because this is very interesting stuff. And when you have to deal with instances of disparities like this, and you know, I'm so sick of the word disparities, diversity, and things like that, and people coming to the table without the best interests of the community. And,
mm-hmm.
and walking away with millions for stuff that, you know, they haven't done. But I'm going to tell you, 2013, Mr. Edwards, should be really different as far as it pertains to the usual suspects and what's been going on for so long in this town, because I'd like to share this. I met with an official from Minneapolis, and that's really all I can say about it.
Okay.
But over the air anyway. And he was aware of a lot of these agencies that have been milking different grantors in the city of Minneapolis and the city of St. Paul and not doing anything, not filing any reports, some of them not even having organizations and still receiving these grants to do this outreach work, this referral work, this cleanup work and things that, you know, are tasked to agencies, some agencies in Minneapolis that do actually do a pretty good job.
Okay.
he says it's going to be a different face on here. A lot of people are not going to be happy. So, and I just like to tip community members and listeners of this show off now.
Uh-oh.
And I like to tell them, when you throw a rock into a pack of dogs, the one who yelps the loudest is the one you hit. Watch in January, because there's going to be a couple of these gentlemen from these nonprofit agencies that are going to be hollering racism, that this is racist, that this is unfair treatment to them. We've been in the community for blank, blank years, and we've always had it like this. But in reality, if you look behind the scenes, just let the dogs bark, because they haven't done anything in the last 10 years here in the Twin Cities.
Or better. Okay.
Yeah. And we do have a call coming in. Looks like.
Oh, let's get it. Let's get it. I'm so surprised.
Caller 202, you're live on the air. What's your name? Where are you calling from? Hello? You're live on the air. If you turn your computer down a little, we can hear you just crystal clear.
Hello?
Hello, ma'am. Go ahead. You're live on the air, ma'am. Hello? Okay.
Yes, hold on 1 second. My aunt wants. Hold on.
I understand.
Oh, she's putting it together on the computer for somebody else. Go ahead. We're waiting.
I have you on speakerphone.
Well,
what's your question, madam? What can we do for you?
Have you heard anything about the murders of Anton and Ramaz in Minneapolis, Minnesota?
Yes, at the beginning of the program, I mentioned that you're talking about the two young men that were killed back in 2010.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and we had their mothers on 2 weeks ago. We've done additional follow-up. There were a couple names that were provided to us. McDuff was one. And authorities are like, they don't know what's going on. They maintain that they've been in contact with the families. We have no reason to doubt what the families have said, because we know some of the homicide detectives. I know some of the homicide detectives. I shouldn't put Mr. Allen in that kind of compromised position. But to your specific question, there's as little now as there was 2 weeks ago or 3 years ago, unfortunately. You know, they don't seem to know anything. We know that there is an individual in the federal penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana, who the police felt was one of the individuals involved in that terrible crime, those double murders. But their rationale was they couldn't get him for the murders, but they could get him for gun running, and et cetera. So that's really where we're at.
Okay, and what about the dog? Why did they shoot the dog and not shoot?
Why did the police shoot the dog?
Huh?
They're asking, Ms. Erwin, why, a question that we probably can't answer, but why did the police shoot the dog? There's a dog shot in this.
Right. Authorities will do that. They really do not have an interest, though they could have called animal control. But it's just kind of a part of being mean-spirited. And if they sense and feel that the dog is threatening, they just go on and shoot him. And unfortunately, that's in that situation, in the shooting of the dog, that's what happened. They should have called animal control. Animal control would come out. They know how to handle a situation. They can collar the dog and et cetera. But a lot of times in police departments across the country, particularly if it's African Americans, they don't care. They just go and kill the dog, go about their business.
Okay, so did the roommate,
the one that wouldn't brush his teeth?
Yes. Why didn't the dog attack? We're just confused about the reason why the dog didn't attack him, because if he lived in a house, the dog was familiar with him.
Yeah. Well, you've just hit on something that the authorities have not wanted to talk about, but it's one of the reasons why they thought that he was not telling the truth. But what happened was, as I reported 2 weeks ago, he lawyered up. After a hour, half hour of questioning on that tragic night, he lawyered up, and so a lot of those questions were no longer asked, and in that they never apprehended anybody, there was not a trial, and so you did not have a situation where people were being put on the stand and asked questions under oath. So That's a very good question. Obviously, you are familiar with this case because very, very few people know about the situation with the dog and the issue of that the roommate, the one that came in, stopped and brushed his teeth and then happened to sashay to the back of the house and happened to realize that his two friends had been brutally murdered. Never could explain that. Never could explain.
But the dog was very trained.
Yeah, he was trained. I'm sorry.
Well, I heard her say the dog was trained.
Very
right.
Trained. That's great. That's okay.
Trained.
We'll continue to make inquiries regarding this as the year closes here to move to an end. And we appreciate your call today. And again, we're our condolences for your loss. And I mean, I really don't know what else to say other than, you know.
Well, let me just cut in and say that so you know that we talked about this in the first 15 minutes of today's program.
Yeah. I apologize.
No problem. This is a serious enough matter where you have a right to ask questions.
Yeah, he was my first cousin.
Yeah.
So I wasn't in on your first call, so but thank you for answering my question.
All right, thank you, dear. Bye bye.
Thank you.
Bye bye. Mm-hmm. I gotta tell you, Mr. Allen, as a member of the Department of Justice's oversight team at the time of this tragedy. Coming out of that, though we had been defunct for 2 years but still had a relationship. That was a piece of information that people really didn't know. So the young lady that just called, she knew what she was talking about.
Yes, she did. She did. Mm-hmm.
And by the way, the roommate, I guess old roommate's kind of disappeared. I don't know what happened.
He's not far. You know, they'll figure out. Something's going on.
Right.
But anyway, again, I'm going to give that number out. That number is, we have a few more minutes here, is 347-426-3904. That's 347-426-3904. Or toll free, 877-537-2878. You can give us a call. Phone lines are open. We're going to have a couple more minutes here, I guess, Mr. Edwards, since we're not doing
Mr. Allen, let me do this for at least for the family. The gentleman that the young lady asked about, the so-called roommate, it's interesting that that is also the person that was identified by both of the mothers when they called here 3 weeks ago. He was the gentleman who, less than a half hour, according to the coroner's estimation of the deaths, the tragic deaths, the torture and murder of the two young men in question, this was the roommate, quote-unquote, who called friends and associates in Hammond, Indiana, and East Chicago, and was telling them that they were dead and how they had died.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when he was confronted with that, that's when he lawyered up, by the way. But so people understand the family's concern about this individual and why more wasn't done, if you will. That was another part of the scenario. And we have that on demand. Anyone that wants to review it, authenticate, if you will, or what we just said here, you can call this program back up on what is called On Demand. Mr. Allen will give you the technical information if you want to call him. You can go back and listen to that discussion with that family. So, anyways, anything, what else we have, Mr. Allen? We're down to about the last 7 minutes, eight minutes?
Last 7 minutes here, yes.
Minnesota Twins, man, I got to tell.
Okay.
Minnesota Twins have kind of gone the way of the Timberwolves, though the Timberwolves are putting a little bit more coloring into the lineup in order to stay competitive in that very tough Western Division. But the Minnesota Twins have basically become a team that doesn't have much use for African-Americans or blacks born of African-American heritage. And so Ben Revis, who, by the way, man, Ben was actually looking for a new townhome here in the Twin Cities. He expected that he was going to be here for a while. He had no idea that they were getting ready to dump him. So what we have here, with the exception of maybe, I'm talking about on their major league roster, with the exception of, zero, we don't have any players of color. We don't even have any Latins on this team right now.
Mm.
Yeah. So the Minnesota Twins, we expect, you know, you the faithful to get out there and support them and pay for them tickets. They have a team that I guess is indicative of the upper Midwest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. And also, they just, you know, since we have the last couple minutes here, today, Mr. Edwards, the Republican Party held a Pick Up the Pieces gathering. And this is really funny because, you know, these I like the comments more than I like the story. And someone here from the Twin Cities told the Republican Party, first thing you guys need to do, or you guys can do, is take your private party agenda and trade it in for a horse. Then shoot the horse. Then any of you that signed a Norquist pledge can get a nice bonfire going. Then you can make a pledge to 100% of your constituents, not just the greedy 2%. So there's some Republicans actually firing back at their party.
Well, yeah, there is a civil war. Some have said that there's a civil war going on inside of the Republican Party. It seems that Speaker John Boehner has basically got his troops back in lockstep. I got to tell you, people were surprised by the resignation or in January that will take place in January of Senator DeMint of South Carolina. Now, it's going to be interesting that Representative Scott, one of the few African Americans, along with what's his name, West out of Miami, who are members of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives, but Scott, if appointed by the governor of South Carolina, could become the first black Republican in the United States Senate since my man Ed Brooke,
okay,
way back in 1979. Okay. Of course, as you know, we have no African Americans in the United States Senate, and so Scott being there would be rather interesting, almost return us to the days of the black coats. But anyways, yeah, there's a real fight going on inside of the Republicans. They're getting kind of nasty, man. Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and them have really been kind of ugly against House Speaker John Boehner and some others. And, you know, Tea Party is kind of trying to modify its its rhetoric and philosophy, if you will. But, you know, the spots on a leopard always stay the same.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't care how a wolf looks or smells, he's still a wolf.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, you know. But that's interesting. You know, watch closely what happens. By the way, we only got X number of days for the fiscal cliff that they keep talking about, whatever the hell that means.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously there's strategy on part of President Obama, there's strategy on the other side. But I think the Republicans, particularly with a by-election coming up in 2 years, I think the Republicans better do a little better step in what they're doing, or they really may be the party that disappears. You know, I said to you a couple weeks ago, the Republicans could very well go the way of the Whigs,
mm-hmm,
which was the political party here in the United States and in America up until 1834 or something like that. And we could have a repeat of history, you know, with the Republicans reverting back to being the Whigs, if you will, and the Republicans disappearing. I mean, it has all kinds of possibilities, Mr. Allen, I tell you. But looks like we're coming up about 2 minutes left.
Yes, 2 minutes left. Any comments you want to make, Mr. Edwards, before we close up the show here?
No, I'm interested in our leadership letting us know what their thinking is with respect to the fact that it looks like they've been cut out of the Viking Stadium. They've called an emergency meeting, talking about an emergency meeting. You know, I hope that they hold a press conference and, you know, at least alert the African-American community how bad things are here for us.
Yes, I hope so.
Yep.
We'd like to thank everyone for listening to On Point with Mr. Ronald A. Edwards and myself. Tune in next week, same channel, same time on Blog Talk Radio, Black Politics in Minneapolis, On Point. And the question that we want to leave you with today is, will we overcome?
We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Ooh.